It's This Is Going Well, I Think, with David Cooper, and I am your host, David Cooper. It is This Is Going Well, I Think, the show where no one's listening. No one cares. The show where every episode's the last episode. Tonight, wonderful things. In about 10, 15 minutes' time, we'll have Dan Riskin fresh off of the eclipse. And this is definitely the second time I've talked to him since the eclipse, because last time after the eclipse, I definitely didn't tape it before the eclipse. I'm going to stop saying eclipse, but you've got science expert to look forward to. And after that, what can your personality type tell you about whether you're going to be single or in a relationship or how happy you're going to be? I'll talk to a psychologist who's done the work. But he's back, he's here, and he's even got a theme song. And now, live from London, England, it's foreign correspondent Tony Five.
Fucking bullshit, innit? That's my fucking mum. Oh, can I swear? Sorry,
yeah.
1 minute. Hello, mum?
Yeah, okay.
I'm just talking to David in America. Let me call you back.
All right, then. Okay.
Say hello to David. Oh, she couldn't care less. How are you, mate? Do you know, that was impeccably timed by my mum. Do you not think? Couldn't have got it any better. What do you think?
Man, your mom's a comedic genius. I love how you haven't been on the show for a few weeks. I have you back, and I'm like, Tony, big intro. Ring, 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 ring. It's your 2'8" Mauritius mother checking in on you.
How are you, my friend?
I am good. Yeah, I'm going to Canada tomorrow.
Wow. For how long?
5 days? It's Passover, Tony. It's the
Jewish
holidays. You have
to get another passport and stuff like that. Is it Passover? Didn't you just have Passover last year?
Yes. I do have to have a passport because it is traveling to another country. So yes, to answer your question.
Is it a bridge?
There are bridges, but no, I'll be flying on a sky bridge, a plane, Tony.
Oh, wow. Do you go first class? Do you go business?
No.
Do you go business? No. Do you go coach?
Why am I paying first class for a 1 hour flight? I hate my money, but not that much.
Is that all it is? 1 hour flight?
Hour to 15? Yeah, it's just...
That's amazing. What did the Jews of Canada do for Passover?
Much like the Jews of the planet, we have a meal. There's this horrible, like, flatbread that we eat called matzot.
Is that like a graham cracker?
No, it's meant, especially if you're religious, to be so bland. But apparently there's a not quite as kosher variant called egg matzah that you're supposed to feed old people who, if they were to eat dry crackers, they would choke and die. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's designed for the elderly and infirm, but that's what we serve because the regular stuff is inedible. It's like an egg crack. It's like a challah bread or a brioche cracker. It's quite nice.
That's very fancy, a brioche cracker. I do like it. So what else do you do? Do you have a meal with all of you guys sat together, like a Thanksgiving type thing? Yeah.
Yes. It's a brisket. I don't know if that's traditionally, but that's what my mom will make.
A beef brisket.
Delicious.
I like with burnt ends and barbecue sauce and stuff.
I mean, it'll be more bland than that. I think it's just like an onion gravy. Yeah, nothing too fancy.
Okay, potatoes?
Yeah, potatoes, carrots, matzo ball soup, which gives us all diarrhea, but we love to eat it. It's like chicken ball soup.
Chicken balls? I didn't know they had that, but I mean, I haven't done geography or biology for ages, but carry on.
How have you been? What have you been up to?
Nothing much, actually. It's been a busy, busy week. I am actually going on a cruise next week, young David.
Oh, my God. Where are you going? To Heart of Darkness, Alaska?
So it's not a gay cruise. I did double check, but it's actually I fly from London to Rome, and then I go from Rome all the way around some little islands, Italy, Spain, Croatia, and then I land back in Barcelona, and I fly back.
And I'm fancy for eating $2.99 egg matzah.
Well, I'm going down in the lower class. I'll be basically rowing. But apart from that, yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm actually looking forward to it. Never been before, so that'll be kind of fun.
Never been on a cruise? 10 days.
Never been on a cruise, dude.
I haven't been on one in about 20 years. I went on one just as I met my ex-wife when I was 19. I remember we were hanging out a lot, and then I went on a cruise, and then we came back, and the rest is history.
Was it fun?
It's fun, I guess. The food, maybe yours is different. I would actually recommend one that is not all you can eat, where they actually have to apply some basic economics to the quality of the food.
I was going to say, if it's buffet food combined with a lot of American people, it's an American kind of cruise line, it's not going to be good, is it?
No, I would have, I mean, my parents were paying. I was 18. Yeah. But if I were an adult, I wouldn't mind going a bit cheaper where you actually pay for your food, because then they have to make it good. Otherwise, no one's going to order it. You know, no one's going to get the filet mignon if it's garbage. Now, this is from zero experience.
Sounds Spanish. I like it. Carry on.
The food was just, ugh.
But really? Was that bad?
It was that bad. We went on two family cruises, one when I was 13 and one when I was 18, one for my grandparents' like 55th wedding anniversary.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other for their 60th. But the one I went when I was 14, I still get made fun of because I was down, maybe I was 13, I was down at the buffet, as you call it.
Yeah, Buffet the Vampire Slayer. Carry on.
Buffy, we call it. Buffet. And I don't know, I'm 13 years old and I can eat anything. And what do I see in the fridge? A delicious carton of chocolate milk. Of course I'm going to drink that.
Right, and then?
And then I go to the buffet and what do I see? All you can eat shrimp. So of course I'm going to make myself a plate of shrimp with cocktail sauce. So I'm sitting there by myself, loving life, eating shrimp, drinking chocolate milk. And my family, rightfully so, points out that this is the most vile combination anyone could ever make. And they still make fun of me for it.
That sounds pretty decent, though. I like chocolate milk and I like shrimp. So, I mean, I'm all right. I'm already all right, to be fair. I'm always a bit worried. Well, a couple of fears, right? So I've had to pay for all the tips up front, right? And you guys in America have this, like, tipping culture. And I don't know what the etiquette is. So, like, I don't know, because they live on a ship, do I give them a life rope? I don't know what to do. Do I make eye contact with the servants? Do I
They're not servants, first of all. Don't call them servants.
Okay, the black people on the boat. Do I engage with them? What do I do?
Maybe you should put on a uniform and go into staff quarters. Do you think they'd let you down there?
I think I might try. I would like to try and drive the boat if possible.
Are you going
to
be?
I've always wanted to do that.
Is it like ethnically segregated? Are you going to be the only black person on there?
It's the apartheid cruise. Have I not told you about that? It's only second to the Disney cruise. Have you never heard of that? It's called Amistad. I'm going on.
There's got to be like popular black cruises, especially for like black communities in the U.S. I feel like people vacation
together.
I doubt
they have
like
it around Brooklyn, David. I'll be honest with you. When I went there, I didn't see any cruise ships.
I just mean like, I don't know. Okay, fine. And the more I go down this road, the more racist I'm
I know. Why do you do that? You know it's a dead entry and you'll never go anywhere further. I just find it, I find that I'm going to be like trapped on this vessel for 11 days. And it's like really weird. Like, oh my God, is it going to...
But it's landing port to port. I mean, you can get off.
It is, yeah. So like one day you're at sea and then you're going back and then another day you're at sea and then you're back. And that's pretty cool. I mean, you could try like international drug smuggling, couldn't you? Going from port to port. That would be pretty cool to do.
You could try it. I wouldn't recommend it.
No. Well, I'm not doing it. I'm just saying it'd be quite cool to do. But yeah, it's my first experience. I thought I'd go whole hog and big balls in and
Have you spent much time on boats before? Because are you sure you're not going to get seasick?
No, can't swim. Sometimes when I'm talking to you on my swivel chair, I feel a little bit nauseous.
Are you scared of swimming or you just can't swim?
Both. So I'm scared for the fact that I can't swim.
Way to play into stereotypes, Tony.
I know, right? But I tell you what, throw me a piece of chicken, I'm right out of that pool.
Well, I understand compounding interest, so I'm playing into the stereotypes of Jews as well. So we all have our...
Yeah, we're doing good. You remind me, right? I always look at you, right? And there is this famous filmmaker, right? Don't tell me, right? You look... Like, now I look at you, you remind me, and it's that guy, Woody, from Toy Story.
I thought you were going to say Woody Allen.
Oh.
Well. I'm not a child molester, but I do have similar vibes to Woody
Allen's
character.
I don't think Woody from Toy Story was a child molester.
If he was, I mean, it's a great...
That would have been a great Toy Story.
It's a great place to be, hiding out in a toy chest.
Toy Story 5, The Pedophile's Return.
Oh, boy. Well, we already were cancelled, so...
Yeah, exactly. So how are you? How have you been? How's the show going?
The show's going okay. It's going okay. It's a show.
Do you have any listeners?
Yeah, I mean, there's a singular listener, yeah.
Okay, if anybody would like a postcard from the boat, please do let me know, and I will get a postcard and send it to you. Send it to David at david.com/David.
Okay.
Is that your email address?
Yeah, it is. If anyone wants a postcard from Tony, email me your email address, david@jew.pizza. It is good to have you back here.
It's good to be back, David. I've missed you terribly. And it would be nice to do some recordings and catch up with you and do some bits before I go, post-cruise, just in case this is my final recording. I'd like going down, wouldn't I? Can you imagine? Can you? That would elevate your podcast and your radio show, right? If I, as a contributor to the show, went down on a ship, not obviously on the girls that I go out with a lot. Yeah, I haven't done that for a while.
Just going on a Cunnilingus tangent right there.
Absolutely. That's the name of my cruise ship, the Cunnilingus. So, that would be amazing. If I went down on the ship, what a great advert for your radio show.
Tony Five, he goes down on ships.
Exactly, yeah. What I do for this show, what do you reckon?
Before you go, you had an idea.
David, listen to this pitch. Are you ready? So I'm going to be on the cruise for 11 days. I was going to send you a really quick voice note every day, 60 seconds of Tony Five on the cruise. But I don't know what it to be called. Like, so I wanted to be like, you know, cruising with Tony Five, but that sounds slightly Grindr.
Well, it's got to have the word semen in it if you want it to be Grindr.
I mean, the naval semen with Tony Five.
The semen's... thrived with Tony Five. The Seaman's alive with Tony Five.
Seaman's alive with Tony Five.
Love it. Okay, well, Tony's going to send us voice memos every day on the cruise ship. I'll play them at the beginning of the show, and when you come back, we will have you, I hope, every day on the show.
We will disembark, David. I know the lingo.
Okay. Tony, I love you, baby. It's a pleasure having you here.
David, always a pleasure, never a chore. And I will speak to you before I depart the shore.
Got it. Just be careful. Don't go too near the balcony. If you get pushed off the boat by some nudnik on international waters, they'll never solve the crime. They don't care.
Is that really lame to do that Leonardo DiCaprio thing on the front of the ship?
I expect photos.
Yeah, it's lame though, isn't it? Like, it's like really lame to do, yeah?
I'm flying Jack.
Yeah. All right, mate. No, I was going to just paint myself naked in a boat somewhere.
Go into the cargo hold and paint yourself naked.
Like a French lady.
There he goes. Tony Five. Coming up next, Dan Riskin to discuss how amazing the eclipse was. Stay with us. Dan Riskin. Dr. Daniel Kenneth Riskin, PhD. Bat biologist, father, crane operator.
Yeah, I'm all those things. I'm also a very savvy style expert, and I can see, because we're talking to each other through a web device, that you got a haircut.
I did, and also I told you I was going to be a little late to this because I had a haircut, which may have also tipped you off. Thank you. I looked like a, as they say, a schlub earlier in the day, and now I'm feeling sharp.
What is it? Does it just remove the L so you go from looking like a schlub to looking like a chub?
I don't know what a chub is. Isn't that...
Chub was a slang for erection in my neighborhood when I was a kid. So
that's British slang. And they call a half erection a semi-chub. I'm surprised you wanted to go right into the blue stuff.
I just was wondering, schlub. I guess schlub just sounded enough like chub that... I don't know. Maybe it's just one of those days.
Chub could be an affectionate nickname for someone who's overweight and kind of like proud of their, you know, body, yeah, as they should be if they want to be. Sure. It's your body, your sure choice.
Yeah.
I'm just looking.
Or if you're just semi-chub like me.
Semi-chub.
I'm a little bit chubby, but not totally chubby. So I'm a semi-chub.
My nickname in university was soft serve because I'm bad at sex. And I like ice cream. That was a joke straight from my act.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. You should keep that in your act. I think that works.
Remember when I did stand up a few weeks ago? That went terribly. Did I tell you about that?
Yeah, you were
already
telling me about how bad, because we talked right before you went and I was trying to psych you up. And then the next day you're like, it did not go well.
I told you the material, and you do that thing when you like someone, you see the best. So the first time I ever did stand up, obviously, it's like, imagine I'd never played the piano and I'm like, I'm going to be a concert pianist. And then I got into a hall with a grand piano and a bunch of people on the violins or whatever. And I sit down to play and all my friends and family are there. They're going to be like, that was great. That's what happened to me the first time I tried stand up. To get the courage, I invited my friends and they laughed at everything I say. I couldn't even get through my quote unquote jokes. And then I walked away thinking, I'm a genius. So I went to an open mic the next day where it was just comedians and like a couple audience member. And that was the rude awakening. So that's what happened to me with you, because you were like, oh, this stuff is great. Because you like me, you know me.
So part of what I think successful comedians do is they build a repertoire, mm-hmm. and then people like them already. And when you like somebody already, you do find them funnier, right? Because you already have all this context. So mm-hmm. when you see a celebrity make some kind of joke versus somebody you've never seen before on social media, it's always funnier when it's, The Rock, he's hilarious. Every time he smiles, I'm so happy because he's such a nice smiling guy. And so, you know, I don't think your friends were lying to you. They definitely probably thought but they would have had a different experience because they knew the context. And so mm-hmm. that's the question, is how do you build that repertoire? And I guess maybe that's the whole point of having a social media following and having people come out to see you when they already know you from social media, is that then you've already got your family around the piano at that stage.
It's funny, TikTokers who kind of blow up by stitching together 30-second clips of them doing stand-up. I've had friends who are bookers, who book comedy shows, complain. They're like, hey, this TikToker had 14 trillion followers. I book them, and they could not do a 20-minute set because it was just such a different format. They're so used to doing their heavily edited 30-second thing that when you put them in a bit of a different medium, different format, like actually getting up on stage and doing long format stand-up, they couldn't do it. Now, that isn't everyone, of course, but the two skills are actually not always translatable. But back to what you're saying about The Rock, it's funny. My favorite comedian put out a special a year or two ago called Legalize Everything. His name's Eric Andre, and he did not write for it. He took his stand-up jokes from the last 5 years that he hadn't done a special with, but there's tons of clips on YouTube, and I'd seen him do stand-up. There was nothing new in it, and to make matters worse, it was a terrible special. And everyone, because they know I love this guy, they were like, did you like the special? I'm like, yeah, obviously I loved it, but it sucked. And I feel like that's sometimes how you feel when you watch people you love on TV, even if what they do isn't great, you like them so much that you like it anyway.
Right. Yeah, that's part of it. And that's also part of, like, if you have a favorite director, you're like, I'll watch this crappy movie because I just want to know the whole canon. Like, and it helps inform the way I understand their other movies and stuff like that. But, you know, I think that's maybe in a weird way, that is a reflection of how our passions sort of carry us through the lulls. Like, you know, I've been thinking a lot lately about, you know, what gets people out of bed to do the things they do for their jobs. Like, most people aren't comedians. They do other things that are, you know, maybe they work for like a pharmaceutical company, or maybe they're like an administrator for a city planning thing or whatever, or they're, you know, writing a textbook about bats. That's me, or whatever. You're going to have days where you like get to do the fun parts, and then you're going to have days where you're like, I got to like organize this stupid spreadsheet and it's not going to be all that fun. And I feel like it's the same thing, right? You love the comedian, even though they weren't that funny that time, you're still glad you went and saw them. And that's a little bit what it feels like to work on that spreadsheet for the book, because you're like, you're excited about the parts of the project that you enjoy. And so it helps you feel better about the other parts. And that's just maybe part of what makes us function in our day-to-day jobs to sort of carry us through, is to be able to like connect the stuff we don't like to the stuff we do like.
Yeah, putting up with the BS. You know, I think every creative deals with this, but I think these lessons apply to non-creatives as well. It's like, yes, I like certain parts of my job, but I have to get through the admin work, the really grind of it. You know, every job, even if you're a musician, you know, there's grind, there's practicing, there's days when you don't want to do those things. Or as a comedian, like getting booked, dealing with other comedians, dealing with venues, dealing with trying to make money. Like, there's so much grind to even what seem like passion pursuits. And I don't know what motivates people to get through the grind, or do they let the grind cause them to collapse? For me, it's...
I mean, some people... Both. I mean, there is also like this idea about how when things are really easy, you don't do your best work. And it's when you have to fight a little bit to make it work that you do better stuff. Like, the easy example is Jack White talking about playing guitar. Like, he says he likes to fight with it. He likes a guitar that's not very like perfect. And so, and if you look at the guitar he used when the White Stripes did their... that big elephant or whatever it was called, the one that was all like red and white and black, that his guitar is like from Kmart or something. Like, he's got a piece of crap guitar like that he's playing, and he just worked that thing. And that was part of the fun for him, was trying to like wrestle a really cool sound out of a machine that wasn't built properly. And I don't know, like that I think can be kind of inspiring. So I had this experience. I just gave a talk at a big conference, and I made it very clear, like, I need to have my laptop up at the front because I like to push the buttons and all this stuff. And then at the last minute, they couldn't do that. And so the laptop was way off to the side. and then my remote wouldn't reach to where the laptop was. So like for the whole talk, I had to be like, next slide, please. Next slide, please. And I basically have 200 slide transitions in this talk because I have a lot of my slides like have builds. And so it was hard. Like it was not that fun to be like, sorry, audience, just let me go off the stage for a second and look at, you know, set this up and la da da and come back out. But I feel like it. I don't know that it was a better experience for the audience, but if it was a good exercise for me, like it really like forced me. I didn't have my slides in front of me, so I had to remember what slide was coming next. And for a lot of it, I wasn't totally sure where it was going next. And so it kept me on my toes a little bit. It was a little harder. And I just felt like, I don't know, more alive in that experience because it was harder.
That's interesting. I mean, there's something to be said for not wanting your tools to be better than you. Back to your Kmart guitar example, but also like your presentation tools in that moment. You know, I put off getting a decent microphone till I got my first check that paid me for doing commercial radio. You know, nice. I used like a crappy mic. I had a good tech job then. I could have afforded a good mic, but I just didn't want to. I didn't want to have like ace primo equipment until I was, you know, capable.
And so you earned it.
Yeah. It was just made up in my own mind. You know, there are $10,000 mics. Mine's like, I think $300 or $400. It's expensive, but it's not, yep. It's not like a Neumann or whatever. I'm getting too much in the audio nerd weeds here.
No, I love it when you say Neumann. Keep going.
Neumann. Is that how you say that?
I don't even know. How do you spell it?
I don't know. I spoke into my friends once because she's a voice actor. And I listened to the recording afterward of me speaking into it.
It's the same.
It was the same. Yeah. I mean, it was a little too sparkly. It was like a little too, I don't know, perfect. And I was like, I like
it. Yeah, unless you're like recording the voiceovers for The Matrix when they're in that white place and all the guns come and appear and they say, I have something to show you or whatever. Like those really crisp lines when they talk in The Matrix. That's where you really need that microphone. But other than that, you're good.
But I think James Earl Jones in my old crappy mic would still do an epic voiceover. Do you know what I mean? It's not, it really isn't about the tools.
Yeah. You know what? I mean, with a camera, you can make something beautiful. With sound, you're really just trying not to screw it up. Like you're really just trying to capture the sound without any like, without like maxing out, without having like a hiss in the background, like just make the noise sound good. That's how I feel about sound anyway. And I know a lot of audio people would be pretty mad at me because you can build a landscape and all that, but really when you're recording sound, just don't screw it up.
But Ansel Adams would have been happy with like a disposable color camera from today's age, you know? I don't know that I agree. I think any form of art, you know, the tools of course are important, but you can create great art with cruddy tools. And there's something to be said for not, like this happens in cycling a lot because I used to race road bikes when I was a kid. And I just had my dad's old hand-me-down road bike because I was a university student and I wasn't going to blow a bunch of money on a Lance Armstrong thing. But there's always be these old dudes who would enter the race who were like business people on the state-of-the-art carbon fiber Tour de France-ready bikes. Tour de France, doesn't matter. And they would stink. And I'd be like, it's almost comical. You're like, you're on a thousands of dollars equipment here and you only ride, you know, once a month. And
it's like Pee Wee Herman riding past all those cyclists. Do you remember that scene when he's riding his bike in Pee Wee's Big Adventure and he's riding his bike past all the people that are racing on their race bikes?
That's exactly it. And then I would do this weekly ride with all these people who actually raced. And this one really good racer, he would always ride his mountain bike in the ride. And he would always, he was a really funny guy. He would let, you know, the weekend warriors in their 50s with their fancy bikes, like pass them. And then he would pass everybody on this crappy mountain bike.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I got carried away there, but there is something to be said for not wanting amazing tools that you feel are going to make everything easy for you. Cause those little micro struggles of actually fighting your tools may actually make you a better performer. I don't know.
Right on. Did we even talk about science in this segment?
No. Let's take a break and talk about more science.
Yeah, let's do that.
More. Some.
Yeah, some. More than zero.
We are back with Dan, the science man, to talk only science, because all we ever do is talk science. We don't just kibitz. We don't just BS. We don't just do stream of consciousness odysseys.
Nope.
Dan, welcome back.
How are you?
I am pretty good. I'm going to Canada tomorrow.
I've been there. Where in Canada are you going?
It's a small city called Toronto. It's actually the capital of its province, but not the capital of the country.
Okay. Do they have any tall buildings there?
Yes. And that reminds me of a John Hartford song called In Tall Buildings that I'm just going to end that that line of thinking there. It's just a good song, if anyone hasn't heard it.
Is it Tall Buildings by John Hartford?
Yeah, I like country, so you got it. It's country.
Is his band also called The Wailers? Because that'd be, John Hartford and The Wailers would be, I mean, that's a great name for a band.
No, I think that's only Bob Marley and The Wailers.
Bob Marley and The Wailers, but then John Hartford and The Wailers, because the Hartford Wailers were the hockey team in the NHL back in the day.
Oh yeah, hockey, love sports. Sports.
Yeah, you love sports. That's why you got that joke.
Go Bears.
By Hartford Wailers.
Go Bears.
Okay, John Hartford, Tall Buildings. I'm going to look it up. In this, wait, is it country, did you say?
Yeah, it's country folk. But he's a Manhattanite, which is kind of weird. But he would go down to the Grand Ole Opry and they treat him like he was one of them, even though he was like a city boy. But he played the banjo and he was a great singer. And okay. It's kind of like the Steely Dan of folk country. Like, the lyrics are kind of complicated and kind of dark and fast. And
is it true that Steely Dan is named after a vibrator?
Maybe. That I don't know. I know that they're not named Steely Dan. It's not Fogerty. Donald Fagen and Walter Becker. Not important. Dan, how are you? I know when we spoke last, you definitely had already seen the eclipse because we didn't tape it before the eclipse and then it aired after. Not.
Yeah.
But assuming we did do that as an exercise, how was the eclipse?
The eclipse was, there's this astronaut in the States for NASA, and he was interviewed about this, and they asked him, like, how good is an eclipse on a scale of 1 to 10? And he said, a partial eclipse is a 7, and a total eclipse is a million. And I think that captures it. It was so, so cool. It was so amazing. And there were clouds where I was, so I didn't even get to see the corona. Like, I saw the partial as it was coming, and then these clouds rolled in, and then but it got so dark, and it was weird. It was freaky and awesome, and the birds were all weird, and it was cold, and I want to do it again. Like, I'm seriously looking at flights to either Spain in 2026 or Morocco in 2027 so I can see that corona. But I will do that again. I would chase those things all over the world. I can see how people get addicted. It was like a emotional experience. It was awesome. Did you go outside? Did you look up?
So I didn't have the glasses. I wasn't planning to do it. And I was sitting in the dentist chair getting drilled, and that's not slang for sex. I was having a cavity filled. And my dentist is this eccentric Brazilian Jew. She is so weird and so funny. And she's like, my next patient just canceled because of the eclipse. Let's go outside. So she drags me outside with her whole practice. I'm with two hygienists. I'm with her assistant. I'm with the receptionist. And she starts taking selfies with me and the dental office.
Are these on the internet? Because I want those pictures of you and your dentist during the eclipse. And can you all come with me to Morocco in 2027?
To the second question, no. To the first question, no. But I might post them today, actually. Why not? Anyway, she yelled at some school children. She demanded their glasses. The kids were really upset. But I did see the partial eclipse on Lexington Avenue and 70th. Wow. On the Upper East Side, which is kind of there's a lot of kids around. You know, where I live, it's less family oriented. So it was kind of nice, although one kid really wanted his glasses back.
You know what? It's interesting. That's funny. What's interesting is the connection to the people around you. So this is one of the things that I found so compelling about the eclipse. So I was with Kelsey McCune, who's a meteorologist who works with CTV. She and I were doing an assignment for the TV show Your Morning. So we were in Niagara, and it was great because that got us a free hotel room, and I brought my whole family. So my wife and my three kids, we all came down. And so we're there at this place called Fort Erie, which is across the water from Buffalo, and it's on Lake Erie. And it's kind of cloudy and stuff, but there weren't a ton of people there. I think that, Niagara said we're going to have 1 million tourists. They ended up getting like 100,000, but they said we're going to get 1 million tourists. And I think a lot of people were like, well, I'm not going there then. And that maybe is why they didn't get so many people. Also, it was cloudy. So I think a lot of people had booked hotels there, but also booked hotels in Kingston and other places. And so when the weather became clear, which it did, a day before, people said, well, I'll go to Kingston, forget staying in Niagara. So it wasn't that crowded. My family was there. Kelsey was there, camera, sound, producer. So there was like a little small crew. And then there were just people on the beach, sort of like it's a rocky beach of the lake, just sort of taking it all in. But when the eclipse starts going and the light really starts. So the thing about the totality is it really does get dark, but it gets dark very fast. And so if you made a graph of brightness versus time, like the drop is very, like the lux per second or whatever it would be, is crazy fast. And so the only time you've experienced lights dimming that fast is indoors. Like there's nothing outside that makes it dim that fast. Like a storm cloud comes, It gets darker, but it takes it a little bit. This was like being in a theater and having a dimmer switch come down quickly, which really is weird when it's outside and it's wide open and it's just getting dark that fast. It really freaks you out. But people were all making these audible gasps. And then when the eclipse happened, people cheered. And then when the eclipse ended, people cheered. And that connection to the people around me, I think, was one of the things that made me feel the most emotional about the experience, was the connection to the people around me. And when you talk about your experience in the Upper East Side and mentioning that all these kids being around, it was an important part of the experience you had. I think that really speaks to what made the eclipse a really neat thing, was the way it connected everybody.
Yeah, it's a certainly a break from our daily news cycle. It's certainly a break from the things that divide us.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Nobody's anti-eclipse except the flat earthers. I do not know the flat earth perspective on.
There may not be an anti-eclipse, but is there an uncle eclipse? Thank you. Good night. what about the Weans? Your kids must have loved it.
Yeah, they did. They did love it. They did. They were jumping up and down. And even when it took us 2.5-3 hours to drive home from Niagara to Toronto because of the Burlington Skyway being packed with people. And we thought we were smart. So we were like, oh, we just won't leave right after the eclipse. We'll wait a few hours and then go after dinner. Apparently everybody did that. So it was, the traffic was awful. But even in the car, I was like, was it worth it? Even with this traffic, when the kids are like, I want to be home. They're like, yes, that was worth it. They loved it. They thought it was really cool.
I think that's any kid's seal of approval, because I used to hate long car rides as a child.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a question there. Oh, I remember the one in the 90s that went, the totality was actually over Toronto.
Oh, and yeah. No, I don't remember that. I didn't know about that one. That's,
yeah. Early that's 90s, 92 maybe.
Yeah, there's one that went through Canada. I don't know much about the historical ones, but that was definitely my first. I mean, were you in a total eclipse?
Yeah,
when
I was a child, and I remember it just being wild. But I remember Hail Bop was in the sky around then.
Yeah,
for like,
okay.
I don't know, was it 92 6 or something? Months? It was so long. And I just remember going outside and looking at the sky, and I'm like, there's a comet with a huge tail behind it. That's so cool. But I also remember thinking, this will just be a normal thing that I'll see as an adult. Like every few months, there'll be a really cool comet in the sky. No. And Hale Bopp's not coming back for what, another 10 billion years?
Man, I can't remember. I can't keep them all apart. I know Halley's every 80 years. That's the one you need to know.
Hale Bopp isn't coming back for a long time. I looked this up recently. It is coming back in. Are you ready for it? Are you ready for it?
Yes.
Are you ready for it?
Is it going to come back before you tell me, or are you going to tell me? Like, which one do I have to wait longer for is my question.
Next time. The next time it'll come is around 4385.
Okay, that's longer than I expected. Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to come back with like 100 years. But
it's got an orbital period of 2,500 years, and it was seen in, like, I don't know, last seen in...
Ancient times?
Yeah, BC. It was the last time it visited was before... Our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. How do I do the cross? Up, down, left, right. Left, down, up, right. Up, down, left.
It's pretty cool when... So there's this other astronomical thing. We only have like a minute left before we're supposed to stop talking. But there's this other astronomical thing where there's going to be a nova. So there's this place where two stars are kind of close to each other, and one of the stars leaks gas onto the other one, and then it blows up every once in a while. And so what you end up with is this bright star in the sky where there wasn't one, and then it goes away after a week. And this happens every... I forget the period of it. It's every 80 years or something like that, or I can't remember the number, but apparently it's supposed to happen this year. There's been some activity there. So we may get another spectacle in the sky. It'll be the size of a star. It'll be a tiny dot, but it'll be bright, and it will be in the night sky where there currently is not a star dot.
A supernova is cool. Yeah.
Yeah. This one's just a nova, not a supernova.
Oh, fine.
I didn't know there was a difference, but a supernova is an exploding star. Novas can sometimes be an exploding star, but sometimes there are other mechanisms that can make a nova. All it is nova just means new, because it's like a new star in the sky.
Ah.
And a supernova is like, whoa. And a supernova, like one happened in the 1600s, you could see it during the day. Can you imagine a star that you could see during the day? Wow.
Yeah. It's so, I remember as a kid learning about critical mass, which is that once stars hit a certain size, they have to blow up, you know? And that's what it is. It's like this critical number of mass. I don't know what it is, but once a star gets that much gas and that much density, it has to blow up because, I don't know, physics. And I just remember learning about that. And it's the same, what's the, they're around a black hole. Like once you cross the line.
Event horizon.
Once you cross that line, you're getting sucked in and you can't see what's out. You can't see what, or no, you can see out, but you can't see in past that line.
Yeah, I guess you can see out. I've never thought about what it would look like looking out from a black hole while you were getting sucked in.
Well, all the light from the universe is getting sucked in, so you can see that light getting sucked in. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe it gets bent so badly you can't see it. But in theory,
well, you're getting bent so badly that your eyeballs don't work. That's one thing.
That is also true. In theory, you could. We're over time, Dan. What are, we didn't mention one. Well, we did mention science stuff, but not.
Yeah, we talked about the eclipse. I think we could check it off. It's a check mark.
All right. It's a shame we didn't discuss all this stuff when we met before, because we definitely met after the eclipse.
Right. This is our first conversation. Yes. No, our second conversation since the eclipse, because we did definitely meet after the eclipse one time.
Definitely didn't tape it before and then put it out after. Dan, always a pleasure.
We would never do that. Always a pleasure.
Eh, I mean, not always.
This time.
Yeah, we've been adversarial before. And
pleasure.
I hope sometime we'll be adversarial again.
Go screw yourself.
Now, before I go screw myself, and thank you, Dan, we are going to talk to a psychologist PhD candidate about what your personality type can tell you about whether you'll be single or alone. And by that, I mean single or in a relationship. I definitely read that copy correctly. So stick around for that. Can your personality type tell you whether you're going to be single or in a relationship? And can it tell you how happy you're going to be? A study says possibly. I have someone here who worked on that. Her name is Elaine Hone. She's a psychology PhD candidate at the University of Toronto. Elaine, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So personality type, are we talking like Myers-Briggs? Like what is personality type as defined by this study before we get into what it can say about you?
Yeah, great question. So I know that the Myers-Briggs MBTI is the most popular personality test. And I hate to always be that person at the party that's like, actually,
Is it pseudoscience? Because that's my understanding. I just didn't want to insult you because you're the expert and I'm not.
Yeah, unfortunately it is. That isn't to say it's not a fun test. That could still be, you know, fun to share with your friends. But when it comes to personality psychology, there is actually an entire sort of subfield dedicated to validating measures of personality. And the most sort of popular model of personality is the Big Five model, which consists of extroversion, which a lot of us know to be those who tend to be more outgoing and sociable, as well as neuroticism, which is sort of like those who are higher negative emotions like anxiety and depression.
Are you picking on me right now and singling me out? You're making me anxious.
But I mean, I just happen to choose those out of the five, but...
Okay, keep going. What is as rigorously defined by a psychology researcher, what are personality types?
Yeah. So they actually spelled the acronym OCEAN, making it a little bit easier to understand. So we talked about extroversion and neuroticism, which is the E and the N, but we also have openness. So imagine a sort of hippie type of archetype, someone who is really open-minded to try new things. They're really curious. They love to learn. So that makes up the O in the OCEAN acronym. And conscientiousness is someone who is sort of really organized, the sort of type A personality that you might often hear about, really responsible. And then, of course, you have extroversion. And then agreeableness is the last one. So agreeable people tend to be really warm and compassionate, have a lot of empathy. So that's sort of actually the most sort of robust model of personality is this five-factor model. And that's what we use in this current study as well.
Got it. I do feel singled out when you say hippies. I do go to Burning Man. That's not important. So what can your measure, if that's the right word, in these five areas tell us about whether we're going to be single or not? Like, how do you investigate this and how do you relate it to whether people are going to be in a romantic relationship or not?
Yeah. So I won't take credit for this model because it actually took like, you know, decades for like personality psychologists to even settle on a sort of like universal model of human personality. So this is a model that has sort of existed for a while. But yeah, we adapted it and sort of applied it to our current study. And in terms of prediction, we couldn't say that with our study because I guess it's not a sort of longitudinal study in that it only takes place in one point in time. So we can't really say like, hey, you being a sort of like really anxious hippie person, you are going to be more or less likely to get into a relationship or not. So we can't say that with our current data. But what we can say is that we did find personality differences. And the biggest difference was in extroversion. So we found that people who were single tended to be lower in extroversion, or in other words, more introverted. And we also found some smaller effects, such that people who were single tended to be a bit more neurotic as well as a bit less conscientious. So I've had some sort of singlehood advocates sort of come at me a little bit to say like, hey, aren't you sort of picturing or painting singles as this sort of immature personality profile? You know, you have someone who's like, you know, a little bit shy and timid. They're a little bit high in like neuroticism. So like a bit anxious and depressed. And also they're irresponsible now too. but you know what? I will say there's potential age differences. So that's another potential thing that could explain what we're finding here. But yeah, I guess that's sort of the gist of what we found. And I guess it's up to you guys or you, your listeners, to really think about how that might apply in their own life as well.
Well, you're not singling these people out. You're researching. I assume you have a hypothesis without a conclusion already. And then you survey them, poll them, interview them, not quite sure how it works. And then you come up with the findings.
Right. Yeah. In terms of methodology, I mean, I feel like this stuff is really interesting, but it's like a lot of people do think it's like sort of pseudoscience, but no, there are entire like degrees and fields dedicated to actually studying this and applying the scientific method to it. And the way that we actually study it is we just essentially survey people. So we typically survey online participants, and we usually just sample them from international pools. So we have people from essentially all around the world, and we usually get pretty large samples. So in our current study, we have about 1,800 people total. We essentially just administer these measures that have been validated. So we're not giving them the MBTI measure, but we essentially ask them about their personality and their well-being, their relationship status, and then we use a whole bunch of fancy statistics to be able to actually find links and associations between those.
Okay, so we got relationship status. What about sexual satisfaction? That's something that you measured against. Who are people, or what are the archetypes, personality types? I'm not a psychologist, that lead to higher sexual satisfaction and then not so much.
Yeah. So in our study, we actually didn't necessarily find super big links with sexual satisfaction. So it was more about the personality differences more than the well-being sort of relationships. But what we did find was that if you think of sort of life satisfaction, right, which is typically a sort of like general measure of like just generally how happy are you? So if you think of life satisfaction as a sort of pie, we found that personality made up more of that pie than someone's relationship status. So it's almost like, you know, if you really wanted to put your bets on like what would make me happier, like, you know, my sort of personality or getting into a relationship, it's probably going to be your personality. And so a lot of people who think that like getting into relationships is going to be your sort of end all cure all of like, you know, this is going to make me the happiest man in the world if I just get a girlfriend or something. That's not necessarily the case. And I guess in this case, science is really showing that it's not really a relationship status that's really explaining life satisfaction and how happy you are. It's a bigger part of it is your personality.
I don't mean to use a fancy word, but being a divorcee, I can tell you, being in a relationship, it's got to come from you. If you're putting it on others, you know, this is my anecdotal conclusion, but if you're putting your happiness on others or things that others control, you're setting yourself up for a real trap there. But the things that are within your control, which is, I guess, your personality, or maybe I'm wrong there. Is a personality in someone's control?
You know what? That's a great question. There are some top personality psychologists in the field who don't think that personality ever changes. And there are, you know, I would say maybe like the newer generation of personality psychologists who do think that it can. I guess fall into that category. I think that personality can change. The thing is that we, I think, all agree on, old or new personality psychologists, is that there is this thing called rank order stability. So basically, compared to everyone in your sort of like birth cohort, you're probably going to stay more or less stable in terms of your level of personality. So if you compare to, you know, your group of high school friends, if you were always the super neurotic person, you're probably going to continue to be relatively the super neurotic person as you sort of go on in life. So that we know. That isn't to say that people can't make drastic changes in their personality, but there is a sense of stability to it. But yeah, I agree with you that it's like, you know, if you are a miserable person, you're going to be miserable single or in a relationship, right? And I hear a lot of stories of people saying like, oh, you know, I've had 100 failed relationships, like, you know, like men or women, they suck. Well, you know what? The only constant in all those situations was you. So
yeah, it's like the old cliche. If everywhere you go, everyone else is the problem, you're the lowest common denominator.
Exactly.
You know what? I tend to agree with you. I think if you're a deeply introverted person, a deeply anxious, deeply social a person who has a lot of social anxiety, you can force yourself to get out there. Like you can do things like, I don't know, Toastmasters, go to an improv class. Like you can make those changes. And just like that, that's the kind of stuff that's within your control. And that's the stuff that you say, and make sure I'm not misquoting you. That's the stuff that can really contribute to your happiness, not whether you're in a relationship or not.
Exactly, exactly. And I will say that for people who want to get into a relationship, that yeah, absolutely putting yourself out there could be one good step. But I think that a lot of, and the reason why we do singlehood research is because there's more and more people that are actually choosing to stay single who don't want to get into a relationship or don't want to get married. And we see this like growing demographic. Part of it, I think, is like economics. Like, you know, it's just more expensive to get married nowadays. And so, and to have kids and to find a place that you could raise a family in, because God knows that rent is so expensive. and so there's a lot of sort of drivers that are, you know, pushing people to decide to be single or unmarried. And so I think that's an important demographic to study. And there's a subset of those who actually genuinely don't want to be in a relationship. So I think that this is sort of like a message to all that if you don't want to be in a relationship, then that is okay too. That like, again, relationships are not the cure all to your happiness.
Were there any exciting takeaways from this survey of over 1,800 people that you were trying to correlate relationship status with personality type? Were there any interesting findings or things that surprised you?
Yeah, I guess I would say that honestly, the big finding of that, like, you know, singles tend to be more introverted was surprising, especially because a lot of my sort of existing understandings about singlehood were sort of catered from media depictions. For example, like, you know, the like movies and shows like Sex and the City or like Trainwreck really depict singles as these sort of like wild animals who love to go partying and socializing and going on like all the hookups possible. But I feel like our data are really showing that that might not be the case. And I think that's surprising as someone who has sort of always been in relationships. I always kind of, you know, the grass is greener on the other side. I was like, man, how fun would it be to be single and like sort of, you know, socializing and going on all these crazy hookups and parties like all the time. But I don't think that's what the data is necessarily suggesting. And it's interesting that there's sort of parallels to existing work as well. Like, for example, books like Quiet by Susan Cain, where she talks about how introverts are sort of undervalued in society. And like, we live in a society that's sort of built for extroverted people. And I think similarly, we live in a society that's built for people in relationships. And there's so much centered around relationships and so much centered around socializing and being extroverted. But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't necessarily fit into those categories. And I think those are equally valid lives.
It's funny. You say the grass is always greener on the other side. I'm thinking of my old psychiatrist. Whenever I'd make life changes and say, I'm still unhappy, she'd say, everywhere you go, there you are. Elaine, thank you for going over this with me. Thank you for your time.
You're so welcome.
Elaine Hone, she's a psychology PhD candidate at the University of Toronto. And that is our show. Thank you for listening. I'm going to be out Monday and Tuesday. No show, but I'll be back Wednesday. I'll be in Toronto, Canada, celebrating Passover with my annoying mother. So thank you, thank me, thank my mother, and thank the good Lord Jesus Christ, our Savior, because I think that's what Passover is all about, probably. So see you on Wednesday.